Welcome to the Final Draft Podcast. My name's Andrew Popel, and today I'm joined on the show by A.W. Hammond. Now, on the Final Draft Podcast, we explore books, writing, and literary culture. Every week, Final Draft broadcasts from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. And at Final Draft, we are dedicated to exploring Australian writing, from debut authors to the classics that you know and love. Each conversation is a way to look at the issues that drive the author's storytelling and help you discover more from the books you love. These are the stories that make us who we are. 2SER broadcasts from the lands of the Gadigal people, and I'm recording on the lands of the Darug and the Gunungurra people. I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of those lands and pay my respects to their ongoing connection to their lands, acknowledging that these are unceded lands and that treaty has never been made with Australia's First Nations. Now, today on the show, I am joined by A.W. Hammond. You have met Alex before. He is the author of The Paris Collaborator, and today we have a follow-up, The Berlin Traitor. This fast-paced thriller revisits, we get to meet again Auguste Duchesne, and we are following up immediately in the aftermath of The Paris Collaborator. Auguste is, he's not in a good place. The war may be ending, but his battle is only just beginning. This is an incredible, fast-paced, and very insightful look at that period that I think often the stories direct our eyes away from. When the Second World War was ostensibly over, but of course the people in Europe were only just beginning to pick up the pieces. I loved reading this book. It's always terrific to speak with Alex, so please join me as we discover A.W. Hammond's The Berlin Traitor. It is my pleasure to be welcoming to the show today Alex Hammond. Alex is the author of The Broken Line and Blood Witness, which was shortlisted for the Ned Kelly Award. As A.W. Hammond, he is the author of The Paris Collaborator. We have heard him on the show before. We love The Paris Collaborator. And today we are seeing the return of his hero, Auguste Duchesne, in The Berlin Traitor. Alex, it's so great to have you here.
Oh, it's wonderful to be here, Andrew. I'm very happy to be back.
And we have Auguste Duchesne returns as Allied forces declare victory in Europe. There's a sense of peace slowly re-emerging on the streets of Paris. Parisians seek to welcome the calm, but only for those considered blameless. Now, Auguste is in hiding. The men who would brand him a conspirator would not stop to hear his side of the story, and so Duchesne must eke out a living any way he can. But would he go so far as to re-enlist? That's the proposal of the powers that be, who are seeking Duchesne's help in hunting a war criminal through the bombed-out streets of Berlin. Now, I want to start there. I want to start right at the beginning. What a great place to start. When we meet Auguste for the first time in The Berlin Traitor, we have all of the events of The Paris Collaborator behind us. He's in hiding. He is branded a conspirator, at least by people who do not know the full story. What attracts you to this fraught moral position? Because, of course, Auguste is never completely in the clear in your books.
No, he's not. And it doesn't get any easier for him through the course of this book. I think having those, the moral question is one that I think it sort of adds an extra layer. So from a critically, and when I'm thinking about writing and what attracts me to this sort of period, is the fact that there is this kind of nuance and challenge around how people progress themselves through the world and how do you get by. And so, you know, in the first book, having Duchesne go through this sort of, you know, position of potentially being accused as a collaborator and certain perspectives I might have seen that he was, but also for the reader, I'm trying to, unpack a rationale for how somebody might end up, you know, and he's certainly threatened to work for the Germans, threatened by the Germans to work for them. But, you know, it's not as simple as simply you just refuse, right? Because your life, the lives of your loved ones, and then all the way through these ideas about survival and, you know, does a baker giving bread to the German soldiers be a collaborator so that they can survive? So that was the setting in The Paris Collaborator. So putting forwards in this one, I guess, too, is this, you know, as the title suggests, there's this question about what makes a traitor. And so I try to build in this layer of moral complexity to sort of elevate what is essentially a thriller. And a crime thriller, espionage thriller, I guess, sort of straddles those sorts of genres. Bring a real question to a contemporary reader, right? So, you know, they would have been very difficult times, I think, for anybody. And what I like to explore, and when I'm writing about the Second World War, is the experience of civilians and how one who's just sort of not fighting on a side, or you know, not but is caught up in the conflict might get by. And so those are where those sort of ideas of moral ambiguity and ethical conundrums sort of bubble up from.
Yeah. The book begins in July of 1945, only some 2 months after VE Day. And in that sort of simplistic historical telling, the end of the Second World War, and it seems to imply the end of a story. Did you have to interrogate your own assumptions to then move into this story? No, there was no ever a stop. There was no they all rode into the sunset to explore how this story might continue.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, the first Auguste Duchesne novel set in the occupation of Paris, that was a setting that I really wanted to explore. So that book, the whole conception of the character, the whole idea for that book arose out of its setting in many ways. Whereas this one, I needed to come up with something to continue the story. And I knew that post-war Berlin would be an interesting setting from the perspective of a detective or, you know, mystery story with somebody has to essentially solve a puzzle because the city has been destroyed. So that's fascinating in the sense that, like, when I run workshops, I recommend to writers to put challenges in front of their characters. And that is definitely a challenge. You know, you have to find somebody, a missing person, but there are no street signs, there are no streets, there are no buildings. How do you find a missing person? So that's how I came to the sort of Berlin setting. But I, other than the fact that I knew a bit, that I didn't really know a lot. So you're quite right. So I then was doing research around it. And there's a very excellent book by Harold Jana, who called Aftermath, and it looks at the post immediately after the war and then further into the sort of 60s of the German experience, an academic. And that starts to sort of really show some of the complexity involved. Like, I mean, essentially, there was these challenges around what you do with all the, you know, prisoners of wars you have, the logistic challenges, the people, you know, the food supply challenges. How do you feed a population? Who do you prioritize in that situation? You know, obviously the Americans and the British and the French were prioritizing their people, but then they still got the civilian population that you're responsible for now. How do you support them through that? And then all the way through to the sort of beginning, you know, almost as soon as the war finished, the beginning of the Cold War, the tension, you know, at Yalta between the negotiations about how they were going to divide up Europe between the Allies and the Soviets, and then how that, you know, pretty soon rapidly escalates after that. So I thought, as I was reading and researching, that this was actually a really interesting moment in history, even though, as you say, things could have seemed to be sorted out. It was, you know, it's that sort of complexity after the sunset. What actually happens, you know, what's the reality of that situation, you know? Yeah, so yeah, it was definitely an eye opener, and I relied a lot on the research to sort of give me those sort of additional insights.
I want to come back to that research in a second, but before we actually travel to Berlin, I wanted to look at the twinning of the narratives, where you actually take us back to Duchesne's early days as, I guess, almost his gestation as an investigator. You introduce us more fully to Sabine. Now, beyond the obvious, which I don't want to spoil, what were you hoping to explore in this interwar period of Paris and Duchesne's history?
It's interesting because there were quite a few things at play we look at 1936 Paris is that period, and then of course the 45 mostly in Berlin, and so I knew that I was going to build towards a story around the ideological and sort of core ideological challenge, you know, position that was put forward at that time, which is between, you know, Soviet communism and you know, capitalism, you know, the principles of, you know, democracy, I guess, in some ways, but, you know, something that was definitely being driven by the growing the arrival of an industrial military complex, which is what basically that started. And so you've got those sort of two ideas competing on a global level. But if you go back to the 1936 Paris, it was an opportunity to explore the sort of perhaps the more, for want of a better word, naive ways that those ideas were coming together and clashing, and also that the emergence of fascism was, that was definitely around. Obviously, we had the Spanish Civil War on. So we're sort of looking at the foundations of what would then erupt into this war, this conflict, and then the post-war period. So that was at a sort of high level. But at a functional level, and Sabine, who's Duchesne's wife, is a member of the Communist Party, so we get to explore at a personal level why somebody might choose to be a member look at her fundraising for the Spanish Civil War and for the international brigades and explore that idea about why people might feel compelled ideologically and morally to go and fight, in another country on behalf of, against fascism. So all that stuff was very interesting, and I thought was laying these sort of foundations for what were essentially ideologies that one might say one is a traitor to. And nation states, which is one could be a traitor to, which is what the sort of book's trying to explore. But from a practical level, I also knew that this was a second novel. So I really wanted to set up a way that somebody could arrive at this book, not having read the other one, and basically other than Duchesne and a little bit of references to his daughter, you could sort of start afresh. And so by choosing a 1936 timeline, it was almost like we're introducing this character for the first time, Duchesne. We're introducing this important relationship with Sabine, his wife. And it's sort of, it's unpacking things in a way, like talking, as you said, he's where he's first learning how to be a detective. Mm. And that way, as a new reader, you're not feeling as if, oh, well, I've got to go back and read the other one to fully grab what's going on. But then it had the added bonus of the two timelines, because Sabine is an important but unrepresented character in the first book. As a reader of the first book, you can then go, oh, finally we get to meet this person that's so significant to Duchesne, who we only lightly touched on in the first novel, and then learn more about her and learn more about what he was like, before the war.
Mm. I got a sense, particularly in these flashbacks, that groups, if we strip them of the facts of their ideology, you had within the streets of Paris, ostensibly Parisians with clashing ideologies, so much to the point they had developed their ideology, they developed their belief to the point that they can't even countenance the possibility that they may not be virtuous, that they may not be true. And that sense of diving so deep into your belief that you're never going to be shaken, you're never going to be looking at shades of grey, you're only going to be defending your position by any means possible. And I may be flagging where my question is going here, but I wonder, did you ever feel your storytelling, or is it inevitable that your storytelling might map itself onto things you see in our world today?
Yeah, you're spot on. I mean, part of what this, it's very, I think it would be difficult to write a book that's dealing with some ideas of fascism and authoritarianism but to the actual personal sort of like black and whiteism of a lot of people's position these days and not reflect that in the book. And I think that's part of some of the way that I'm trying to, in my own small way, explore these ideas about absolutes and absolutism and sort of challenge those. And the espionage and thriller genre really lets you do that, because, with the likes of Le Carre and a lot of other writers before that, or Mick Herron today even, who writes in those sort of similar areas, I think everybody expects a sort of moral grayism. You really want to show, oh, it's not that. So it lets you play with those ideas and say, look at these absolute, people's looking in black and white, and then you arrive at an outcome that's a lot more complex and grey and not as clean cut, and the motivations aren't what people are necessarily, when they're verbally saying that. And the 36 allows you, 1936 allows me to sort of position those, and then almost 10 years later we come back and say, well, actually, that a certain character was presenting in a certain way may not actually have come through that war experience, and they're not quite like that anymore, and they're a lot more politically motivated or personally motivated, and those ideas are actually just ways to justify their own personal behavior, you know. So, yeah, you're spot on. It was definitely something to do with it. And when I started writing it, unfortunately, the war in Ukraine had just started. And, you know, so I'm obviously writing about a lot about the experience with Soviets, but, I mean, we're talking about, for the most part, Russia. And in my own way, I wanted to track some elements of that fraught history between Russia and Ukraine in this book, which it's only in a very little bit, but, you know, I just wanted to remind everybody that these things harken back a long, long way. So, you know, all the way back to the Ukrainian famine, where you saw, you know, Russia taking food out of Ukraine to feed its population and Ukrainians starving. So, yeah. So it's just sort of trying to show, you know, that these things, I guess, it's all connected. It all flows through to the modern time, but also there's a precedent for this, and we need to sort of guard against it. You know, I don't think we can just simply step away from it and say, yep, that's all done. No problem with neo-fascism anymore.
I think perhaps we might be giving the listener a sense of the depth and the excitement in this book, because realistically, we haven't moved terribly far into the narrative or even into the book. We're only a few chapters in at the moment. But of course, Duchenne is going to be transported to Berlin. No spoilers there. The book's called The Berlin Traitor, everybody. He is going to pursue a Gestapo agent who captured him in Paris. But he arrives. The city is unrecognizable, even to those who knew it well. You've talked a little bit about your research already, but I actually wanted to get to this. This is what intrigued me so much. A book sings for me when I can, you know, close my eyes and walk the streets with the characters, especially if it's a, you know, an imagined land. But I wondered for you, what did it take to evoke the seemingly mapless terrain of Berlin in the immediate aftermath of the fall of the Nazis and the sort of the end of the ostensible end of the war?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that draws me to writing these books, is wanting to evoke those. So thanks for picking up on that. I mean, it's a big part of what draws me to writing in the historical setting, is trying to evoke those periods. And I honestly feel for any writer who's writing historical settings pre-photography, because I rely a lot on photography and some sort of film footage from the time to help me wrap my head around what that would look like. And, you know, no surprises, the Second World War is very well documented in terms of photography and imagery. And so I started with photos and with the sort of British Pathé, some of the old reels that were captured, filmed, you know. And some of them are aerial. They filmed out of planes to show the sort of devastation of Berlin. And that really gives you a sense of the scale of how this place had been shelled to pieces by the Soviets and bombed by the Allies. And so I started there. And then also on the ground, to sort of the lived experience, there's a book that I also refer to. I drew from a lot called A Woman in Berlin, which was written anonymously by a journalist who had lived through the occupation. And it's not an easy book to read in any stretch, because, you know, as the Soviets come in, there are multiple war crimes being committed. But in response to the way that the Germans behaved when they're invading Soviet territories, I mean, not justifying it, but rather giving it that sort of context. Mm. And she writes about some of the sort of just day-to-day stuff on the city that is just fascinating and really gives you that really sort of lived experience of people on the ground. And so I sort of drew from some of the footage. You know, a picture paints a thousand words. Like, literally, you can just look at a photo and start with a, you know, that describing that scene, and that's, you know, sets you up for a chapter. And then, of course, I had a lot of maps from the time that I dug up online that helped me just make sure I was in the right areas of Berlin when I was writing about it.
And as he navigates, Duchenne shows us the Berliners who must exist in this world that's been destroyed, and you engage through Duchenne, and also we'll perhaps meet Captain Ray in our conversation in a minute. You show and question the culpability they have for their destruction, sometimes just for existing within a murderous regime. And I wondered, did you come to any conclusions, or were you even seeking to come to any conclusions about what duties citizens have to resist injustice, even at a cost to themselves? And again, I ask these questions and I hear myself mapping contemporary issues onto them.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And I don't know if I arrived anywhere definitive. I think it's hard to, right? Because I imagine, you know, I think people very easily come to a very black and white and have in the past said, well, obviously for Germany, I would, you know, resist, you know, the Nazis. But if that means your death, maybe you wouldn't. Mm. And so, yeah, I kind of wanted to, but I didn't want to step away from that, make it all too simple. And so that's one of the, I mentioned Harold Jana's book, because he doesn't let, I mean, initially after the war and reading that, there was a very, everybody's very quick to move on. And it was actually the sort of generation, the sort of what we would call, I guess, the baby boomers, who challenged in the 60s, you know, during the sort of student revolutions of that time and the student, you know, dissent and protests. That in Germany, that's where these questions were being seriously asked for the first time, to sort of say, what was our culpability in this? It's all too easy to step away. And so their previous generation didn't talk about it. Everybody moved on. You saw that there were, you know, Nazi officials having to be reemployed because the infrastructure wasn't there to support the real buildings of cities. And the knowledge was contained within these sort of, you know, card carrying party members who had been mayors or civil servants at the time, you know? So, they didn't want to address it for the immediate challenge of having to survive the circumstances that they're in. But also at the same time, Jana doesn't let, and nor did those sort of children let everybody off the hook and challenge that sort of in the 60s. So it's the student questioning, how much are we accountable? How much were we in supporting this regime? I don't think they're simple questions to answer. I mean, without getting too deep and heavy, I mean, I don't think, like, there's obviously citizens in Russia at the moment who don't agree with the war. But if imprisonment is the outcome of being too vocal, how vocal would you be, you know? And we wouldn't hold all of Russia accountable for this, you know? So I don't think there's any simple questions, but it did make me sort of step away from my belief that, oh, well, if there's a citizen, you wouldn't have been able to do much, to sort of thinking, well, I guess there's a, you're tacitly accountable, you're tacitly allowing this stuff to sort of bubble up. So maybe if I could walk perhaps you could say a line of, if you nip it in the bud early before it becomes a case of, you know, armed SS, you know, officers, you know, executing people on behalf of the party, executing people for being traitors by not standing against, you know, the invading Soviets, you don't have to get to that point to resist. There are ways of resisting earlier and just being, yeah, as a citizenry aware of what's happening.
And I think
yeah, even, I don't know.
Even to bring it a little closer to home, if we, you know, before we ever get to morality at the point of a gun, when you're presented with an opportunity, it's easy to feel as individuals that we have very little agency or choice in the big decisions being made. But when you're presented with an opportunity to say yes or no, I'm flagging this terribly, but, like, yeah, we have opportunities. We have opportunities in our lives to make these decisions. And I thought it was really interesting the way you played out those conversations through the novel. And of course, the decisions we make and what lengths we will go to address a larger issue turns several pivotal moments. It's time we need to introduce Duchenne's nominal partner, Captain Ray. He's something of a loose American with a way of getting around the bombed out city. Ray is determined in his mission, the mission that he and Duchenne are going to complete. And through this, I feel like you were pointing to their future, which is our history. And what's really interesting is, of course, when we read historical novels, unless they are taking us into the realms of counterfactuals and or the fantastical, we know in some broad brushstrokes the way this ends. But did you ever see alternatives or turning points or anything that suggested that this wasn't all horribly inevitable?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I wasn't really sort of exploring that as much in the book as knowing I sort of wanted to signal to the reader, as you just said, like we sort of have the benefit of hindsight. We know where this thing is going to play out to, and rather play with that anticipation and expectation in both books. It's an interesting one. I mean, Ray is an American. We have the, and as I've already alluded to, the sort of inevitability of the sort of Cold War and that conflict. And a lot of, I don't think it's spoiling too much to say that a lot of what he and Duchenne are trying to do in the streets of Berlin is that they're in a race against the Soviets, who are also seeking the same war criminal that you refer to. So that's sort of my way of sort of on a sort of smaller level, playing through what was going to happen on a more grander level for the world. I think that's that very thing that you mentioned. That's what I was trying to play with, is more our understanding. I don't know. I feel like it's hard not to deny certain inevitability of things when you reflect back. I don't know. It's the counterpoint would be we were really talking about a sort of Soviet and American arms race, and moving towards the, threat of a nuclear future for what would have been for them. I don't know, like, what was the alternative? The Soviets invented the bomb before the Americans or the Germans did? I mean, it's the Germans doing it. That would have been a very different in some ways.
I mean,
perhaps, it's interesting. I think there is an inevitability with it, I think, for me.
Perhaps there was only alternatives that were even more horribly turned out. And sorry, Alex.
Yeah, the ones you wouldn't want to consider.
And forgive my visitor. I actually feel a little bit like a Cold Warrior, a Bond villain at the moment, as one of my cats has decided to join the interview. Captain Ray was a fascinating character where you obviously like him. You obviously signal to us that he is likable. But in pairing him with Duchenne, I was really curious about how you wanted to approach this idea of idealism versus pragmatism. Duchenne is very much still the idealist. He refuses to re-enlist and takes on this mission as a citizen. Captain Ray obviously has his beliefs, but he hints at almost this foreknowledge. He knows this must be done at all costs. Like, what was that tension there?
Yeah, I guess it's so on one level, it's and it's hard for me to talk about these things without thinking about what I'm trying to sort of do as a writer to make a story interesting for a reader. And you sort of want to put your two central characters in some way. Well, there's three central characters in the book. There's in 1936, there's Duchenne and his wife Sabine, and then in 1945, it's Duchenne and Ray, and you want to have them in different views, because tension, disagreement, different viewpoints builds for interesting drama. If everybody's in a furious agreement with one another, it's not necessarily the most there's no conflict. It's less interesting story. Duchenne is a man who's been through the First World War. It seemed logical that somebody coming out of that situation, although we didn't have a word for it, there would have been a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder. There would have been people suffering from that experience in a very sort of mental and physical health way. So he is essentially a sort of kind of proto-pacifist. I mean, pacifism was around as an idea, but he wouldn't describe himself as such. But he's essentially a pacifist. He's driven by these ideologies of nonviolence because of what he's been through. And so that makes it more interesting when things start to escalate in the thriller and, all the guns come out and people are shooting at you. It sort of lets you put a character in who has those views and challenge their views very directly. Ray, I needed to have him still appear as very much a sort of soldier, because that is what he is, although he's a bit of a sort of – he's – interprets things very loosely and doesn't necessarily play by the rules, and is very cavalier in his approach. But that's sort of was a counterpoint, yes, to Duchenne, but also a way of sort of showing why he would continue to be employed as a professional soldier if he's if he can be a bit fast and loose with his way of getting about. But I also wanted to contrast that too with, because historically when the GIs arrived, they were seen to be, although they obviously were a highly professional army, but perceived by the European notion of what an army, how an army would behave, is to be very unprofessional. You know, whenever they were marching, they didn't have their uniforms in complete, like, you know, high order. They weren't in lockstep. They, you know, would be riding, hanging off the back of trucks and everything, and calling out to the civilians. And they seemed to be very
wasn't that the
not quite what they were expecting?
Wasn't that the sort of the cliched? I don't know if this is a historically accurate thing that was said, but I know I've heard it appear in narratives of the Second World War. There's only three problems with the Americans: they're overpaid, oversexed, and over here. Something like.
I think that there was certainly in it. I don't think that's necessarily inaccurate. It's just a different approach, I think, and that's why everybody is so surprised, I think, when they arrived. And so I wanted to embody that a little bit, because that's the sort of the American that we see through the most part of this book. But in answer to the question, yeah, absolutely. It was around these competing just ways of giving a different conflict between two separate characters, and explaining why they were able to be like they were in the historical setting that they inhabited.
I could just imagine some sort of, stars on the shoulders, walrus mustachioed general sort of looking at Ray and saying, "I don't like him, God damn it, but he's effective." He's really a very lovely character, and I'll probably cut short what I want to say about him there, because of course so much of his and Duchenne's fates rest on how this latter part of the novel plays out. I might finish with a character who, as you already pointed out, was much spoken of in the first book, who we now have so much in Duchenne's, in the 1936 narrative. And I don't want to say any more about 1945, but you have an obvious affection for Sabine. I'm talking about Sabine here. I questioned about whether there's even... even a third novel on the way. I'm thinking of European capitals and fun sobriquets that you can add to the Prague. So I don't know. Do you feel though, like you mentioned Sabine is a communist, do you feel like a character who has allied herself with the rising Russian powers of 1945, could she ever get a fair hearing even today, even sort of in this world almost a century later?
Yeah, that is an interesting question, right? And part of setting it starting in 1936 is to show how somebody can get sort of wrapped up in something without knowing necessarily where it was going to go. Although the signs were there, and that's clearly one of the things. I mean, 36, we have Trotsky on the run. You know, he's in Mexico at this point. The Soviets are, the way that the Communist Party is behaving is not one of like a, you know, it's not a gentle party. There's executions, there's, so you can see what's happening. And Stalin, obviously, we know where everything's going to go with Joseph Stalin as readers, but she doesn't. So a lot of that was sort of to explain how somebody could be of that ideological view, because she's come up from the unions, she works on a factory floor, she can see the need to defend workers against exploitation. And I think that's something we can all relate to. And then to walk that forwards, as we go. So that's part of, that's a big part of it. I think the other thing that was important for me to show is how Duchenne could have affection for her. And there's this big question in the book, which is set up fairly early on. And again, I don't think it's giving too much away. And it's certainly referred to in the prior novel, The Paris Collaborator, is that she goes and fights in the Spanish Civil War. And we need to explain how she would feel so motivated and so passionate that she would leave her husband and her daughter behind. And I think that was also part of wanting to sort of really explore these ideas. You know, she's younger than Duchenne. She hasn't seen or experienced things, which is not to in any way patronize her. But she's wanting to take those steps of exploring her ideological view of her passions and pursue them, you know, where he has already almost sort of done that. So he has to see coming from a slightly different lens. Yeah, and it's a very critical relationship throughout this novel, and I wanted to explore in a kind of interesting and mature way conflict between a couple, you know, and how that will play out at various different times. Can we forgive her? You know, I would hope so. I mean, I think part of what also I try to do, and as we explore this character and you sort of show how sort of things can just progress and you get caught up in something. And then even if you're changing your view or you don't have quite the exact view as, you know, Stalinism does, but you're still a Leninist, you know, but to be a overt Leninist at that time or present a different version of communism is probably dangerous. So again, it's that, how do you get along? How do you survive in those situations? You know, when you've already found yourself sort of trapped in them.
A few ideas. I've been completely thrown off again by a visitor.
No, that's all right.
Of course, it is also extremely interesting. I think you've just destroyed my entire train of thought. Sorry, Hip. signaling that I will need to do a big edit here. I noticed you deftly dodged whether there's going to be a third book. I believe there's going to be a third book. The best I've got here is the Bucharest the Bucharest Betrayer. I'm trying to find a little bit of a little bit of assonance or something here for you.
If I'm fortunate enough to get the opportunity to write a third book, because these things are always a question of, you know, that's the nature of the writing industry, is a question of how successful books are like in terms of their sales and how they're also their publishers feel they can have continued success with them. There's definitely an idea I have for a seed for a third book. I have a title in mind. Would probably possibly be something along the lines of The Moscow Defector. There's a lot to explore in this history. I haven't quite landed on it, but I think there's also a lot around the airlift in Berlin and the, you know, when the Cold War is really properly underway and you were having to fly tons and hundreds of tons of supplies in to West Berlin to keep the Allies, you know, while there's a blockade of around the city by the Soviets. That's an interesting period in history, but also just to explore a bit further and into this idea of the Cold War. Yeah, there's a lot of fascinating things to draw on too. There was a whole conflict around art, weirdly, between the West and Soviets, and Soviets were into realism, and the Western art movements that we've been pushed forward were sort of more abstract art, and there's possibly something to feed in there. I mean, these are all sort of ideas that bubble away, and I think I try to hold off thinking too far down the line because I have experience having strong ideas about what books should be and plotting out in my mind all the way through to, you know, fifth books and then unfortunately they never see the light of day and you don't get to realize them and you feel like you've a little disappointed with that. So I have some ideas. They're lightly held at this point, but definitely think that there's opportunity to at least get one other story out for these characters.
Tremendous. I like the idea of the Moscow Defector as well. The other idea that I also just wanted to present as you were speaking there about Sabine is, of course, you challenge enormously the idea of ideals and actions simply by ending the novel in early August, where early August, 6th of August, 1945, and the characters are only just coming to a consciousness of what the next stage of world history looks like. And of course, while Ray and Duchenne have been fighting to stop something that they believe could be absolutely dreadful for the world, something else is happening outside of their control, outside of even their awareness. And I thought that was, there's no question here. I just thought that was a tremendous leaving off point that, of course, is always in our minds. It's always in our history. But to show that growing awareness for your characters was enormously effective.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. That's the benefit of having the history there, because you can really pick and time when you want to tell your story for sort of maximum impact. So, it was, it's one of the sort of the easiest part about writing these books in some ways is to sit down with a timeline of world history and events and work out when you're going to set it. It's very liberating in some ways because it takes a lot of the pressure off you as a writer to have to even come up with what season is it, you know, it's summer because that's when this thing needs to happen, or the end of, you know, late summer. It's highly intentional. I'm glad it resonated. It was something I was hoping to do in some ways, because in the last book, which it ended with the sort of liberation of Paris. And while that's an important piece of history, it is almost as like a closure that's a bit too warm and fuzzy in some ways for my liking. I still managed to work in a bit of the sort of gray stuff about in there, but this is a sort of, it's almost like the sword of Damocles, you know, there's this thing hanging over everybody's head.
A.W. Hammond is the author of The Berlin Traitor. Alex, thank you so much for taking the time to join with me today. I would leave just a final thought for the reader that the entire thrilling mystery of the book has been left for you to discover. We have walked around the edges of it, but The Berlin Traitor it's truly a page-turning read. Alex, thanks so much. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, no, thank you, Andrew. Always a pleasure to have these conversations. Thank you very much.
Huge thanks again to Alex for joining me today, and thank you all for tuning in, for having a listen, for supporting this show. This is Final Draft, and today on the show we featured A.W. Hammond's The Berlin Traitor. Final Draft records on the lands of the Darug and the Gunungurra people. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. Now, stay in touch if you want to reach out, if you want to let us know what you're reading, if you want to know what... I want to know what you're looking forward to in 2024. Next week, we are starting off with the incredible new releases that have been coming out over the summer and the books that are going to be coming up in this first part of the year. What are you excited about? What are you looking forward to? And if you want to do that, if you want to reach out to us, well, you can find Final Draft. You just send me an email if you like. Finaldraft@2ser.com. On the socials, we are at Finaldraft2ser. And it's always great to hear from you. My name is Andrew Popel. I am going to be back with more incredible conversations with Australian authors here on Final Draft. And as always, as I am about to go and do, I wish you happy reading. Goodbye.